KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In her decades as a foreign affairs correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, Elizabeth Farnsworth covered everything from Cambodia on the brink of a military takeover to the AIDS epidemic in Malawi and Botswana. In her new memoir, A Train Through Time, she weaves stories from these assignments with memories of her childhood and of her mother, who died when she was 9 years old. We'll talk to Elizabeth Farnsworth about her book, The State of Journalism, and the dangers facing reporters working in conflict zones. It's all coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. As former chief correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, Elizabeth Farnsworth has reported from conflict zones across the globe, covering everything from the AIDS crisis in Botswana and Malawi to the Iraq War. She's also an award-winning filmmaker whose works include The Judge and the General, a documentary about the human rights crimes of Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet and the struggle to bring him to justice. But Elizabeth Farnsworth has also wrestled with personal tragedy, the loss of her mother to cancer when she was just 9 years old. And in her new memoir, A Train Through Time, which is set on a train ride from her hometown of Topeka, Kansas, to San Francisco, she weaves stories of her news assignments with reflections on her childhood and her mother's death. And she joins us in studio now. And I almost wanted to say welcome home, because I used to see you in the halls all the time, although home for you is still Berkeley.
I'm really glad to be here. It's been a while.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here, delighted to have you here. So what holds a lot of this book together, and what I suspect was really the catalyst, was being a motherless child at the age of 9. It shaped you. It made you who you are.
It did. And I always thought I might want to talk about it, because as I looked back and explored what it did, I thought I might help other people who were trying to help a child who'd lost a parent. But it's something that journalists don't like to do. Some journalists, at least I'm one of them, we don't like to talk about ourselves. So I never really wanted to talk about myself personally in that way. And then I had this powerful experience that I write about in the book at Skywalker Ranch one day, and it made it impossible not to write about this.
I don't know if we should talk about that powerful experience and give away what it is or get to it in the course of time or not. But that personal tragedy that you went through also had a real tie-in to what you encountered as a journalist, which had a lot to do often with terrible tragedy and devastation, mass death. I mean, you were exposed to a great deal of danger, too. Many perilous places, and there is a connection there.
I think there's a connection. I didn't used to think about this much. It didn't really occur to me that there was a connection. And you know, the first person that ever asked me a question about it was actually Duc Nguyen, who was the host of Pacific Time here. And he used to do a lot of voiceover translation on Vietnam stories that I was working on, and in a documentary that I also did about Vietnam. And one day he looked at me upstairs here and he said, "Elizabeth, you could be reporting from Paris or someplace like that. Why do you keep going back to these dangerous places?" And that really started off sort of just in the back of my mind, trying to figure out if there might be a link. And I think there is. The book is
Duke
my
was a poet
answer.
As well.
So yes, and a wonderful writer.
No, but I just mentioned that because he kind of has that insight in some ways that really was useful to you. You know?
Very, very.
A poetic insight. Really.
Yes, very. But I think, in my case, losing a parent very young made me very interested in other people who've lost everything or lost a lot.
What advice would you give? I want to certainly get into the content of the book and some of the things that you did as a foreign correspondent and so forth, and just how difficult it is nowadays for foreign correspondents. But any advice, any wisdom for, for example, I know a young woman who's probably dying and has a 9-year-old child, and what family and friends can do and what they ought to do.
I think my main advice is not to assume that your child understands what's happening. I think the research also shows that until you're 10 or 11, you can't grasp the nature, the foreverness, I call it in the book, of death. And somebody just the other day who lost a daughter was asking me about some behavior of her grandchildren. And I realized that the behavior she was describing was shame. And I think this is what people don't realize. You feel ashamed unless it's been dealt with really wisely during the illness, because you're so different. No matter how careful your grandparents, and my grandparents were wonderful, my aunts, I had what I call good bad luck, and that I had so much support. But they can't know, for example, that it's Mother's Night at the Girl Scout troop, so you show up without anybody. And the emotion I felt that I remember, and this is so hard to explain, is shame. So when you're dealing with a child, really very sensitively or quietly or simply ask questions to see what it is they're really feeling.
You would think loss or grief would outweigh shame, but you're saying no.
I can't explain it exactly. I mean, in a way, this is why I had to write this book, which involves a lot of, I guess you'd call it imagining, and because there's things I can't explain except through symbols.
And in fact, in many ways, you make your reader mindful, a serious, attentive reader, of that slippery slope, perhaps we could call it, between memory and imagination, between what we summon in terms of our remembrances and what is, well, imagined.
Yes, and I kind of want to make a plug for imagination. I've been thinking about it a lot. I think imagination is a way to understand, especially a child's world, and you need to use your full imagination to really understand what a child is thinking. But I think it's important for everything. I had imaginary friends. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I did. His name was Michael Berber.
Mine were Racatunia and Tana Yunya. And they were always in Kansas City when my parents would ask.
And we were talking about your work as a foreign correspondent and how it ties in and so forth. You're really, in this book, kind of breaking down time. You're doing some really astonishing things with time, just in terms of how it flows out of memory and how much of it is involuntary and how much of it is really beyond our control. With respect to the imagination, particularly.
Don't you feel that is kind of the way time is? If you and I sat here and talked personally right now, I would imagine that not very far from your present moment is a memory from a past that you could describe to me in great detail right now.
Well, Proust described it best. It's involuntary memory, and yet it's fused with imagination, even more perhaps than voluntary memory.
I think the Greek goddess for imagination and memory is the same person.
We're talking with Elizabeth Farnsworth, and she's here with us in studio. I wanted to touch also on what we alluded to earlier, the danger now of being a foreign correspondent, especially in these conflict zones that you were so well established in. I mean, think about somebody going to Syria, for example, and getting important information about what's going on with ISIS, but the kind of threat that is faced, you know, decapitation or being held prisoner for long periods of time, it's true almost in any conflict zone.
I think one of the biggest changes for me in my life since I started reporting in, 1970, I guess you'd say, is the growing danger for journalists in many, many parts of the globe. And I sensed all this after 9/11 and even before 9/11. I sensed that something enormous was changing. But it has become very, very difficult to report some places. And as you can see in my book, I'm somewhat obsessed with the fate of television crews, who are much more endangered, I think, than anybody else, especially if they're looking through a camera and can't see what's behind them or around them, and especially with the fixers, the interpreters, the people that are like field producers, that in a very dangerous place, which whether it's the highlands of Peru or it's Iraq or parts of Cambodia when we were there one time, they're the ones that I really worry about. And in fact, a fixer that I worked with was killed after we had left Iraq working with the New York Times. And he's somebody, as you know from the book, that I can't stop thinking about. So that's something I'm very concerned about. And it's, you know, Mark Danner said recently on a panel that I shared with him, I never dreamed that I'd have to consider beheading as a possible consequence of my work.
You also talk about the consequences of the work in terms of the effect on other people. And let me give a quote from you. I don't believe I have the right to decide what story is worth another person's life.
Yes. And this, of course, is a this is very personal. It's possible that I came to this conclusion because I was older. I really feel for young people that are starting out now because they have to make all these decisions. But it became, after several episodes of danger, especially to fixtures and to crews, I did decide that I wouldn't go back to certain places. And this thing that happened to me at Skywalker that set off the book was partly a result of both a fatigue over the film about Chile and years of doing that work and not quite knowing what I was going to do after the film was done. Would I go back to the Middle East? After 9/11, I spent several years reporting only from the Middle East. And so I had to think about this very, very hard, and I decided I could not go back and work with somebody that I thought might be killed if we left. You do, I think you probably know this. There are correspondents that truly endanger their fixers. I have worked with fixers who have been endangered in really irresponsible ways for correspondents. They may be very rare, but it does happen. And when I speak to students, I warn them about this. I tell them you have to
consider.
A fixer,
you mean?
Yeah, the fixer's the local interpreter that you hire who interprets, but you look for somebody who really knows what's happening so that they can sense a danger when you can't. And hopefully they have a lot of ties in all different kinds of groups. I've been absolutely blessed with the fixers and crews that I've had. And they're the people that I think about the most now.
And many are concerned now with the president's ban, of course, that those fixers and those people will not be as accessible or as available. You have a lot of compassion, a lot of heart for so many of these people who come under suffering. You write about the devastation in so many countries where you were indeed working as a journalist. And it brings up another question in my mind. I'm sure you read Janet Malcolm, and back in the day, you know, she was talking about journalists and their responsibilities and the fact that in order to gain the trust, they have to...
They have to seduce people.
Actually used the word seduce. Right. You're absolutely right. To seduce people and sometimes, you know, use mendacity or whatever wiles they can. Yeah.
This is something that I do not think we should do. And I think especially when you're in a dangerous place, I think you have to be, and now, I mean, fortunately, this is something I'm so happy about. The Committee to Protect Journalists, all kinds of groups have put out guidelines for dealing with fixers and dealing with the people that you could endanger in a foreign country. And one of the guidelines is that you have to make clear to that person what you're doing, how it might endanger them. If possible, everybody that we work with in a dangerous place should have the training. Now, the CNN, BBC, all the people that go to very dangerous places have to have training, both in how to avoid psychological and physical damage. And I just want to say that Agence France-Presse has gone so far, and I called them to find out whether this is still the policy. Starting in 2014, they said they would not take freelance stories from certain areas in Syria and certain dangerous places that they wouldn't send their own people, which I think is just so great, so moral. And yet, I'm also saying we may not get the news from those places. So this is a bit of a contradictory stance.
It's
I'm
a thorny
very
and vexing problem. We're talking Elizabeth Farnsworth, by the way, author of A Train Through Time, A Life Real and Imagined. She's a filmmaker, journalist, and former chief correspondent for PBS's NewsHour, and she'll be reading at Mrs. Dalloway's on February 15th, and she'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madeira on March 6th. And many of you, of course, remember Elizabeth's work and, like me, have certainly appreciated it and continue to appreciate it through the years. Talk about, which reminds me, the last time I saw you, I believe, was with Juan Guzman, who you made a film about called The Judge and the General. And I met him and was rather impressed by him even before I met him because he was a guy who, was sort of on Pinochet's side and then realized just how much iniquities were there and turned over.
Yeah, I think he's not exactly what we would call the good German, but he's close. He wasn't the good German in that he really did eventually see what was happening and changed the way that he was behaving. But he came from a family that was very traditionally, in sort of the best sense of the word, conservative. His father was a great poet, a diplomat. They had military people in the family. So under the Allende government, and he had small children, it was hard to get medications. He thought the Allende government was not doing what it should be doing, and so he did support the coup at first. He and his family, the poet, his wife, Judge Guzman and his wife, toasted the Pinochet coup in 1973 with champagne. And the film is about how he changed, and we thought it would take maybe 2 years to make the film, but it took 4 years before he indicted Pinochet, and then we had to wait to see what would happen with Pinochet, and he died before he was tried. But as
he was indicted, though, and placed under
house
arrest.
Indicted. Yeah. Judge Guzman was the first person to indict him in Chile. Yeah.
Which was in itself a pretty daring thing to do. But
let me
jump from there to get your sentiments. You've certainly expressed strong sentiments about justice being rendered and about the importance of it being rendered in cases where, there was an indictment of the president of Guatemala and Spain, this sort of thing.
But, and in Guatemala.
And
in
Guatemala
itself,
right. These
are things I thought would never happen. This was like the movement towards international justice that, honestly, if you told me that Augusto Pinochet and Rios Montt in Guatemala would be indicted and tried, Rios Montt was tried and found guilty, by the way, and then there's various things that happened after that, I would not have believed it. So, yes, those things happen. Go ahead, I interrupted you.
I was also thinking about Steve Bannon saying we have a global Tea Party going on as opposed to that kind of international cooperation. I'm wondering if I could get you just to opine, you don't have to wear your journalist hat now, about Christopher Hitchens was on this program, may he rest in peace, many years ago. He'd probably balk at me saying that because I didn't believe in God or any kind of afterlife and peace afterlife. But, he said Kissinger should be tried. And there are those who said Cheney and George W. Bush should be tried on foreign grounds. They're traveling through Europe, arrest them like Pinochet was arrested and put them on trial.
I don't think I will opine on that.
You're still the journalist at heart?
I am, and I've certainly reported. I mean, Kissinger's in this book, and I have plenty to say about it.
Yes, you do, which is why I
asked you. Opining
on
whether they should be arrested overseas, no thanks.
Well, whether in the sense of international law, though, or justice, let's not even use Kissinger specifically, but, someone who has committed these crimes.
I think that in recent years, there are plenty of leaders I think it would have been difficult in some ways for some people to travel overseas because there was a period when, what they call international jurisdiction was happening a lot. But I don't know. I have a rule that if I haven't reported specifically about something immediately, I just don't much opine about it.
Well, you mentioned that you were in Cambodia once. I believe, were pretty pleased when Khmer Rouge leaders went on trial, weren't you?
Yes. I've reported from Cambodia a couple of times, and there's another trial, that a whole series of trials that took place that I don't know that I would have believed could happen, and it did. And I think it gave many, many people there's so much to say about the trials when they don't necessarily result in people being put in prison. But I think that just being able to go to talk about what happened to you and have people believe it and have people listen to the details is tremendously important for people.
And Chile, as you said, remains in some ways very much in your memory. But I imagine you were in Vietnam and Saudi Arabia and Haiti, and these are a flood of memories that just keep coming back?
Yes. Well, I think the book helped a lot in
sorting them out.
Yeah. What happened in Skywalker, I don't think it's giving away too much because I write about it on the second page.
You might
page.
As well. Elizabeth.
I'm not going to give away. The book is a mystery. There are several mysteries in the book, and thank you for not revealing them. It's a mystery that I'm trying to unravel, and in order to do it, this actually happened. Memories I call them illuminated memories. This is not an ordinary chronological memoir. I'm really taking memories that came pushing at my consciousness. It happened because I think I was tired. Blair Gershko, the editor, and the sound mixer, Pete Horner, and I were working at Skywalker Ranch. We were mixing the sound for the judge and the general. And that this is a very tedious process sometimes because
Blair's a good friend. I know exactly how tedious it is.
Well, so. And sound mixing is, Pete's a master at it, and he might play one sentence 40 times to get the sound as crisp and clear as he can. You're cleaning up sound to make sure that it not only has the same volume, but the same tone, and you're not changing anything, but we call it, you know, cleaning up the sound. So I was listening to a particularly horrendous story, sentence after sentence, time after time, and I just sort of got up and went out of the studio. And the mixing studios are in the technical building of Skywalker Ranch, which is, you probably know this, is a beautiful, almost, it feels almost sacred. It's so beautiful, beautiful building. And there's an atrium right below where we were mixing with a skylight. And TikTok, the character from many Oz books, a mechanical man, in this case he was from Walter Murch's 1985 film Return to Oz, had been sitting every day. I'd pass him in the atrium. We'd been mixing for a couple of days, almost a week, I think, because we had some problems in the beginning. And, maybe 3 feet tall. He's cardboard, but he looks copper. In the books, he's a copper man. He can be wound up after he winds down, and he can speak then, and he can move. And I saw TikTok, and I'm from Topeka, Kansas. I love the Oz stories. I think I've read most of them. I have a tremendously wonderful memory of my mother taking me as a child.
How many times did you say this must not be Kansas anymore?
Probably a lot. We felt it was kind of our story, and Dorothy seemed like somebody I knew. So I looked at TikTok, and I had this, it was almost like, it was such a powerful experience. It was as if, I know this was imagination, but it was as if I saw myself as a child. And that child said, "Why have you taken this path through death and destruction?" And then these memories started coming back.
It ignited.
It ignited.
It was a kind of an epiphany, really.
It kind of was.
But also, I'm not going to give anything away here, but There is a horse in the story, and I just mentioned that just sort of as a tease, so people will want to find out the way you alluded to it.
Especially horse lovers.
But also, horse, for Freud, was memory. You know, riding the horse is really going, I don't know if you knew that.
No.
He wrote about that in his own writings. I always am hesitant to bring in Freud because, you know, he's sort of fallen into disrepute to some degree. But we're talking to Elizabeth Farnsworth, who is author of A Train Through Time, A Life Real and Imagined. Many of you remember, chief correspondent for PBS's NewsHour and filmmaker, journalist. She'll be reading at Mrs. Dalloway on February 15th and Book Passage in Corte Madera on March 6th. And we invite your calls and lots to talk about with Elizabeth Farnsworth. You may indeed remember some of the stories that she was involved in and her work, work which I know she is righteously and justifiably very proud of. And talk about, you know, the difficulty of journalists in foreign lands today and just all that they face, not only foreign correspondents, but journalists in general. Some of you may have some thoughts you want to bring into that. Or also, we're really talking about memory and how memory works or doesn't work and how it fuses with imagination and how the two have a very integral interplay between one and the other. Please feel free to join the conversation. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and you can call us and join us now again at 866-733-6786. A number of other ways to join us, you can email us, forum@kqed.org. We welcome your comments and your questions and thoughts, and you can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Elizabeth Farnsworth with us in studio has a new book called A Train Through Time. And in her decades as a foreign affairs correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, she covered everything from Cambodia on the brink of military takeover to the AIDS epidemic in Malawi and Botswana. And the impressionistic memoir she's written called A Train Through Time weaves stories from these assignments with reflections on her mother's death when she was 9 years old. Talking with her about her book and the state of journalism and dangers facing reporters who work in conflict zones. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. And as I said in the beginning, at the heart of the program is the loss of a mother. And it would be certainly worthwhile and probably enlightening and helpful, I think, for maybe people who have been through that experience or who have in some ways endured it, faced it, to at least tell us, stories are welcome, about how you were able to move through it, especially if you lost a mother or a father as a child. We do welcome your involvement in the program, and our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and you can also email forum@kqed.org or Go to our website, kqed.org/forum. And Mark asks, could you elaborate on the dangerous situation foreign journalists are facing? Specifically, why did journalists go from being viewed by the people they covered as helpful in broadcasting their cause to being the enemy?
That's a really good question. And of course, we're not viewed as the enemy in all places. I think I could give an example. Here's the example I would give to answer that. Let's say Steve Talbot and I made a film for KQED about Guatemala called The Gospel in Guatemala. And we were in the highlands of Guatemala in a town called Nebach. And the Guatemalan military had just wiped out several villages around Nebach. And there were refugees. And they were telling stories of war crimes, basically. And we interviewed them, and then we interviewed a colonel in the military. Why did he talk to us? Because in those days, and also we ended up interviewing the president, who was a general, and they wanted to talk to us because in those ways, that's the only way they could get their story out. And, you know, they wanted to get U.S. aid. They had various needs. And so they needed to talk to American journalists to get their story out. People don't have to do that anymore. There's every way to get – there's so many different ways because of the internet to get stories out. That's why ISIS – I mean, ISIS is –
they're masterful
masters,
with the social
right,
media.
Right, with propaganda. Yeah. Yeah. So we're not necessary to those people in the same way anymore.
Well, the stories that you got out of Guatemala – let's just focus on that for a moment. Had a lot to do with thousands, literally, of leftist guerrillas who were being killed, over 400 villages that were essentially decimated, refugees going up into the mountains and dying of hunger. I mean,
yes.
There were so many stories to tell that even at that time, when before the internet, there must have been a difficulty kind of deciding how to triage it.
It was difficult for so many reasons. It was hard to get up there. It was difficult. In a way, it was difficult to make people or to tell a story that people could believe, because if you say that 400, you're right about the four, I think it's like 423 villages were destroyed in this counterinsurgency war. And to come back here where most people didn't know about it, and in those days there were, there were people that supported that kind of policy in Guatemala that we're talking about it, and then to tell stories about the kinds of brutality in those villages, it was difficult, and to decide just what stories to tell. Yes,
there's also you're concerned, I know, about and Guatemala is a good example. So is Chile, about truth and rendering after the fact, trying to find justice, people telling their stories and what they went through and trying to get them out there, and almost the catharsis of getting them out there. You see that as being really a vital part of coming to some kind of, some kind of peace within oneself and within the country itself?
Well, I don't think impunity helps anything. I mean, I think that if there's a goal of judging people, and if they're found guilty of putting them in prison, or if they're too old, you know, holding them under house arrest, whatever the penalty is, I think that is what should be done.
But make them answer for their crimes.
Make them answer for their crimes. I mean, one of the problems, by the way, with the killings of journalists, I mean, in 2016, there were almost 100 journalists and media workers killed in the world, according to the latest figures. And one of the biggest problems is that the impunity for journalists being killed in conflict zones is almost, I think it's, I may be wrong, but it's like 80% or something like that. And as long as that is the case, it's not going to stop.
You know, the counter argument in countries like Chile or South Africa, for that matter, if they didn't have the reconciliation and the impunity, the immunity, they wouldn't have had the testimony.
Yes. I mean, I admire what happened in South Africa. And Chile took a slightly different – I mean, that has happened to a certain extent there, but they have actually put people in prison. And the stories that I tell in here, the people that have been indicted and tried for killing those people are either in prison or still being tried for other crimes too.
Comment from a listener says, good journalists are good storytellers, for sure. I think you would agree with that. You talk about after 9/11, you talked to members of the Muslim Brotherhood. Can I get you on record on that?
Sure. Mary Jo Brooks and I went to Egypt, and this was right after 9/11, to report on the Muslim Brotherhood and other matters, the Muslim Brotherhood being sort of the group that gave rise to what people call radical Islam, in a way. It's interesting that the person that sort of did the original writing about it went to Colorado Springs and was so offended by the dancing and other things he saw that he went back and then began to write about how Islam should not go along with these kinds of things. But yes, we did, and I interviewed people from the Muslim Brotherhood. I think the person that we interviewed was later arrested, and I don't know what's happened to him now, one of the main people that we interviewed. Mary Jo and I had, it wasn't the easiest shoot, but in Egypt we were treated pretty well. The whole time we were there, we had a little bit of trouble. We got
became
temporarily
very rough for women, you know, in recent years. Much rougher
very,
for women
yes,
journalists. Yeah,
yes.
Yes. Yeah. Let's talk about the NewsHour. There's been a lot of concern about whether it's going to be able to continue, whether it's going to get the revenue or the funding and to continue. And they had to drop a lot of people from the West Coast. Our own Spencer
it seems
Michael.
To be going really strong, though, doesn't it? Have you been watching?
Well, here's what I was getting to with this: that in the what's being called the age of Trump. I mean, we're in a pledge drive now, and I can't remember our doing this well. There's the appreciation.
Tell me about that. I didn't know about this.
Yeah, no, I think we're doing very well, and that's not to suggest that that people shouldn't contribute or think we're doing too well or anything. But it's certainly representative of the fact that people are terribly concerned for this kind of journalism. It's given us a different berth, a different silo almost.
Yes, well, let's hope that the same thing is happening with the NewsHour. I'm going back next week, so I'll find out. But I think the NewsHour is just doing a wonderful job, and I can't imagine that they won't continue.
They had to lay off people, and you know, the Trump administration has expressed open hostility to PBS and to NPR.
Yes, I think everybody's concerned about it.
Actually, some of you who are listening may want to weigh in on this as well. So let me give the number again. It's 866-733-6786, especially if you watch the NewsHour. And if you've watched Elizabeth Harnsworth and certainly appreciated her work, you may want to come in here with questions or comments. And you can email us forum@kqed.org. We do, in fact, want to hear from you and hear your involvement. But it's a different kind of journalism that we do. And it's, I mean, you know, we can stand proud and all that and maybe even speak too chauvinistically about what we do, but it is, we like to think, real journalism.
I'm certainly proud to have been part of the NewsHour. One of the luckiest things that ever happened to me was coming to KQED. And as a result of coming, you know, I started at KQED in 1975 as the panelist for Latin America on World Press. And that work led to other work, which led to other work, which led to freelancing for the NewsHour. And I'd say maybe most of the stories in here were done either for the NewsHour or for KQED or in connection with them. So I'm really grateful. I'm very grateful to the people. And by the way, I'd like to say that I'm glad you like the book. And I think that the book wouldn't exist without Brenda Hillman, the poet, who when this happened to me at Skywalker, I reported it to her. She's a friend. And I told her what had happened with TikTok. And she said, I really think you should write about it. And she and Eve Pell and some other people pushed me, really. I mean, urged me to write about it. I said, no, I don't want to write about myself.
You're mentioning two of my women friends slash heroes.
me too.
Yeah, no, they were both terrific women. Paul writes, I'm curious about Elizabeth Farnsworth's views on the situation for journalists in the United States under President Trump. As a candidate, he cast doubt on reports tying the killings of journalists in Russia to President Putin.
Well, I think this is a time of great challenge for all of us. And I think we have to be as careful as we can to get the stories that we report right. And I think that in the end, if it's true, it will last. And if it's not true, it won't. I mean, I know that sounds a little bit Pollyannish, but I think what I'm saying is I don't want to see people who exaggerate or overstate all the things that we shouldn't do, no matter how upset we are with somebody calling us names, which is happening. Journalists are being called names by people in the government.
There seems to be a war with the media.
Yeah,
from this
so it's a time to be. This is a time to really think hard and to report very hard. I'm very impressed with the major newspapers, especially the Times and the Post right now. I think their reporting is very good.
What about the Times coming right out and saying Donald Trump, President of the United States, you're a liar.
Did they do that?
They did that. They used the L word.
Oh, that's right.
They didn't mince. They used it.
I think there's some very good reporting now. I do think, remember that I'm from Kansas, and I've spent a lot of time in Kansas and Minnesota, and I do think that there has to be a lot more reporting of the lives and the troubles of people who did support Trump.
Just let me go back for a moment with you to Latin America, because because that's where so much of your time and effort, and you alluded earlier to where your start began, all those disappeared. You know, you wonder what happened to people who you interviewed and who you reported on, and all those people who disappeared, particularly in places like Guatemala and everything. We don't know, and we may never know what happened to them.
No, and I think people know because it's been written about now, but the worst thing that can happen to a person who loses a loved one is then also not to know where they died, how they died, or where they were buried. And that's why the situation of the disappeared is so tragic for people. And imagine that in Chile they were tied to rails, train rails, and dumped into the ocean. And in The Judge and the General, we filmed somebody bringing up those rails. And that is something people don't recover from. Although I think one of the things my book is about is in some ways people don't recover from tragedy, but in other ways they do. And there is something about terrible tragedy that some people react to by affirming life even more than they did before. And those are the people that I, especially in this book, I really do remember. I remember these four women in Vietnam, for example. And people ask me, who are the favorite people you interviewed? And those are the four people. I think I interviewed two of them that are my favorites.
Extraordinary resilience and ability.
Extraordinary. Yeah.
Let me get some callers on here. Let's go first to Bill. Bill, you're on the air. Good morning. Bill, are you there? One more time for Bill. Bill from La Honda. We got to say goodbye because, I don't know. Let me go to James next. James, you're on. We having some problems with our phones here. James from Mill Valley.
Yes. Hi. Okay. Yeah. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Nice to hear a human voice at last. Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you. I would like your guest to contrast the Obama administration's clandestine efforts to block out the press with our current president and his administration.
Yeah. Thank you for that question, James.
What do you mean, clandestine efforts to block out the press?
From my understanding, when he ran for president, he promoted the idea that he was going to have transparency in everything that the government did. But from my understanding, he did not speak to the press. He did not let the press in on anything that he was doing at the time.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, James, but during the Obama administration, there was a lot of very strong criticism about the lack of accessibility. I think that's pretty much what he's talking about, even though the promise was to be totally transparent.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't compare them because there's not that much to compare yet with the Trump administration. My experience, my friend's experience with the Obama administration was not bad. And so I can't really respond to that. I think I understand what you're getting at, but I personally did not have any experience with the Obama administration because I was doing other things.
You were talking before, and James, thank you for that, about the differences vis-a-vis the Internet and the age of the Internet. You ever think a president would be tweeting out messages constantly, almost addictively?
I didn't. I haven't. I didn't think it would happen.
Question from Robert. Ms. Farnsworth, what responsibility does a nation's private citizen bear to avoid undue risk to his or her life from the physical threats of foreign malefactors, to avoid placing not only their nation's foreign policy in peril, but also the safety of its armed forces deployed nearby?
Could you read that again?
That's a tough one. What responsibility does a nation's private citizen bear to avoid undue risk to his or her life from the physical threats of foreign malefactors, to avoid placing not only their nation's foreign policy in peril, but also the safety of its armed forces deployed nearby?
Oh, I think I understand that. In other words, does one have the right to go to a foreign country, which is very, very dangerous, and then expect help from, say, the Navy SEALs if they're
I think
abducted.
That's the import of the question. Yeah.
I think it's a good question. I think this is what I say to students when I speak now. I say, think very hard about the consequences before you go. I could see I could see how it changed when people got the very small portable cameras and they could edit on their laptops. I would get calls from journalists saying, I want to go to Iraq. It was when Iraq was still dangerous. And they'd never reported overseas. They'd never done anything in a dangerous place. And they want to go to Iraq and report, which stayed dangerous for quite a while, by the way, after the invasion. And I do think, I say to people, think hard about what you're doing. Think about your own family and what it would mean to them. Think about, yes, you're going to call. I got help from our embassy when we were detained and then deported from Haiti. Yes, you're going to call on it for help. So you have to be very responsible about that.
And we'll be responsible of bringing more of our callers on. Let me get Ken on next. Ken, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hey, one thing that has been really, really more important than ever is what the truth is. And for me in journalism, that's objectivity. At the local, state, and federal level, we have the Office of the Independent Legislative and Policy Analysts. And often they'll take an issue like immigration and just go for, against, and, you know, any conclusions, but it's a balanced approach. And too often in the news, it's one side or another. And I'm wondering,
can we make a distinction between balance and objectivity?
Well,
because they're very different concepts.
Basically, as a voter, I want to hear all sides so I can make a decision. And as a journalist, especially in television news, you have so limited time. I know Andy Rooney did a brilliant piece on how few minutes there are to the actual news during a program time. And I'm just curious, as a journalist, do you, you learn so much, but you have to filter it down to basically headlines. Do you ever feel like you'd like to write the full version and, you know, another format, like a blog or something else? I hate to use internet words.
Let's hear from Elizabeth Farnsworth, and thank you for the question.
I think that we were so lucky on the NewsHour, and especially when I was reporting for the NewsHour, the stories that I reported with wonderful crews and producers for the NewsHour would be between 12 and even 16 to 17 minutes long. They were mini documentaries. So we really did get the time. And as you know, Jim Lehrer and the NewsHour's Judy Woodruff now and Sarah Just, the executive producer, they are sticklers for telling both sides of the story. And so I think that there are places that you can get that. Now, this is a topic we could debate for the whole day now, because there's always the thing that people say, do you tell Hitler's side of the story? So this is something that we when we write, we try to give you as much information, at least I have. And honestly, we don't always succeed. I understand that. Nobody's perfect. As we can, and the most important information, and let you make up your own mind. I mean, I really believe
including alternate facts?
No alternate. I really believe that if you get the information you need, you'll make up your mind in a way that will be intelligent.
I'd like to believe that, and certainly we do here at KQED and the news that we bring and what we do on Forum, but I've always been very suspicious of that word objectivity in journalism. I remember Mark Dowie, a great journalist, who once said to me, you know, subjectivity, language, it has to come into play. You can't...
Just the stories you choose to cover.
And just what you cover, exactly. Plus, getting back to your story, another word that I confess I've been suspicious of for many years is closure. When people undergo losses like you did, it can last a lifetime. It's not something that you can put a closure onto. The grief can stay with you till the grave.
Well, I agree with you about this. And do you really want closure? I mean, you want to. I feel about them all as sort of live ghosts in my mind, the people that I love that die. And the older you get, the more people you know that have died. And I wouldn't want them all to go away, really. You don't want them to be having an effect that is ruining your life. But I kind of want to feel their presence in a way. And yes, I think that's why people so much like Manchester by the Sea. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons. Isn't that the name of the film? Because it doesn't include closure. I think people appreciate that.
It is a grim and depressing film in many ways, but it's a wonderful film, and the film has certainly touched me, and even has some humor in it with the young man and so forth. I just want to get that in there. Owen writes, Jim Lehrer was my commanding officer in the Marine Corps. He was great to work for in an otherwise rigid environment. I wonder if he was as good a boss at the news
hour. Oh, he was wonderful, yes, and boy, did he love the Marine Corps. Yes, he was a great boss.
Semper Fi.
I feel so lucky to have worked for Jim Lehrer and Robin McNeil and Lester Crystal and Linda Winslow.
And Elizabeth Farnsworth is our guest, and let me remind you that A Train Through Time is her new book, A Life Real and Imagined, and she will be at Mrs. Dalloway on February 15th, Book Passage on March 6th. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio, so for more information about how to support this radio station, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we're going to go to more of your phone calls. Let me go next to Catherine in Sacramento. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a delight to talk to you, Elizabeth. I wanted to share that, you know, my father died suddenly at the age of 12, and it really impacted the rest of my life. I think it really was a predictor for a path that I took as being really someone that looked at life in a black and white manner. I think there's many good aspects of it, but also there could have been some wrong turns. But I'd like to know your opinion about having sudden death happen to a child at a young age and how that really would affect the rest of their life. I also have a daughter who's just lost a best friend at the age of 27 to a brutal murder. And, it's having to help her deal with this tragedy as it will definitely affect the rest of her life. So I kind of wanted to know what you see as ways to help people go through a sudden death.
You know, I don't have much experience with sudden death like that, but I have great sympathy for you and for your daughter's friend. And I think that it probably affects you in a very different way than the disease that took my mother, which took several years, because the sickness is in some ways as devastating to a child as the disease, as the
suffering.
Death. Yeah, suffering. To feel empathy for a suffering parent is almost an existential threat for a child, I think. It's something that I've learned just thinking about it. But sudden death, how awful for you. And there's nothing that prepares you for it. And of course it does. I would think that it undercuts, you know, your faith in the universe in a way that even a more prolonged death doesn't. But I don't have any expertise in this at all.
Well, Catherine, thank you for bringing that to our attention, and I hope things go as best as they can with you, and I appreciate hearing from you. And we're going to hear next from Anne in Oakland. Anne, join us.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just, my mother died when I was 3, and I'm 52 now. I've given it a lot of thought, and just wanted to mention that I think it would be wonderful or good for people, friends of mothers or parents who die when a child is young, to give really detailed, wonderful, full three-dimensional stories about that person. Because in my experience, now it was a long time ago, and people maybe didn't deal with grief in the same way, but I only got idealized views of my mother. Because people wanted to be nice and say nice things, and that's fine. And I just wanted to know more. I would love to know more about her. Did she have a temper? Was she funny? You know, I never learned those kinds of things. So I have encouraged, unfortunately, I had a friend who had cancer and young children, and I said, please write down stories or talk to your kids in detail about you and what you thought of them, and encouraged friends of hers to tell the kids those detailed stories. So that's just, I just wanted to say.
Including, you mean flaws and eccentricities and quirkiness,
yes,
and all the rest of it, yeah.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
Wonderful idea.
Yeah, I didn't know my dad until he was 93, so I really knew my father. And he was a wonderful man, but he was also a very quirky man. And I thought, gosh, did my mother ever get annoyed with him? I mean, no one ever tells me that, you know.
You know, there's a wonderful book about some of this that I read long ago by Hope Adelman called Motherless Daughters, and I would recommend that book. And I know there are other books, too.
She's been on this program many years ago. I think it's in our archives. That
uh-huh.
We did.
I think it was very helpful to me. It was something that I thought a lot about writing myself. I gathered research about it, and then when I read that book, I didn't think I needed to. That's an excellent idea.
And let me thank you for the call. One more caller from Richmond. Beryl, you're on. Morning.
Good morning. I'm calling about the assassinations that are still taking place in Central America, I think, of people who are trying to protect their lands. And I only hear about it on Democracy Now. I was wondering if Elizabeth could comment and whether there's broader coverage of those events aside from Democracy Now, whether you know that or not.
Are we getting enough coverage on that period, Elizabeth?
I think probably not.
Yeah, I agree.
It's very dangerous for people in some of those areas. And, you know, I don't know about it. I haven't been reporting on that, so I can't help you with that. But if it's happening, it needs to be covered.
And let me thank you and read a comment that gives you plaudits for your work in Central America. Jackie writes, thank you for reporting on Central America and other hotspots in the 80s. We depended on your stories to help educate refugee and immigrant students who participated in the Bay Area Children of War group. Many of them volunteered to speak to their U.S.-born middle and high school peers who benefited from learning the facts through their stories. And just a quick note from Tracy. She wants to see the judge and the general for years. Is it available anywhere? I think it's available, according to our producers, on PBS.org.
You can it is. I think you can buy it on PBS.org, and I think you can. I think it's pretty easy to get anywhere.
Elizabeth.
Amazon.
Congratulations on
Thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much for joining us. The book, again, is A Train Through Time, A Life Real and Imagined, and she'll be at Mrs. Dalloway's February 15th and Book Passage in Corte Madera on March 6th. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forums produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Rob Spate, engagement producer Amanda Stupai, and we get support from Amanda Font. Holly Kernan is our executive producer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.